So I'm here with Andy Goodman, Group Director at Fjord and contributor to Designing for Emerging Technologies. Andy, thank you for joining me today.
Pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
I'd like to start with talking just a little bit about your background and your work. So could you tell me a little bit about you?
So I've been working in interaction design pretty much my whole career. I remember back in the mid-90s, it was all CD-ROM. So things have moved on a bit since then. But yeah, I started in the industry really before it was, certainly in the UK, before it was an actual a real industry as such, or even before the terms and the roles have been well defined. And I've kind of moved around various different sectors of that industry. I've worked in the kind of product side, working for interactive TV and games companies. But most of my time I've spent on the agency side, which I think is, where I personally feel most comfortable. I'm someone that likes looking at lots of different things. And I think when you're working on product side, you need to have a real kind of concentration and intent to work on one thing for 1 or 2 years or however many. And that never really kind of worked for me. So yeah, I think I found my home in agency land and specifically really in service design, which, I mean, it's been an academic discipline for a while, but it was only in the beginning of the 2000s that actual service design agencies started emerging. So before Fjord, I worked for a small service design agency called Sarin in London, and then joined Fjord in 2008, which was I guess a kind of inflection point in my career. So I'd always been pretty much a hands-on designer up until that point, and since then I've got more into the strategy and management side of things.
Okay, great. You mentioned service design. I'm curious how you define
Yeah. Well,
that.
it's a well-known thing that if you ask 10 service designers to define service design, you'll get 10 different answers. So I'm sure what I say will be highly questionable, but for me, it's really about thinking on a system level about design, not thinking about an instance or a product or a touch point, to use the jargon. It's actually thinking about how systems, and not just computer systems, but how human systems and computer systems and physical systems all interact with each other. So you need to be thinking not about individual moments. You need to be thinking about maybe thinking about journeys and flows, and thinking about how a human being naturally will, without even thinking about it, move from one context to another using different devices, using physical objects, being in physical spaces. So for me, it was a very, a very appealing, this idea that you can design more than just interactions in a way, more than just interactions on a screen. You can actually design other things that are more how the way we live and work and play.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. A holistic view of it, really. Which seems to me that given where we're headed, every designer is going to need to understand service design.
I think, well, I would hope so. It's good for agencies like us that we're talking this language. And I think this is kind of where I was hinting at when I was describing service designs, that really it does almost preempt this idea of these kind of technologies that we've been talking about in the book, where we're bringing together all different kinds of things like sensors and analytics and anticipatory kind of computing to provide this very fluid experience, taking you away from just tapping away, pecking away at a touch screen into a more naturalistic way of interacting with your environment and with the built and designed environment.
Absolutely. So one of your contributions to the book, to Designing for Emerging Technologies, is focused on embeddables. Can you talk a little bit about what you find to be some of the more interesting examples of embeddables or where it's headed. What excites you about it?
Yeah, well, maybe it's worth kind of going into the term a little bit, because it was something that came to me, but I'm sure other people have come up with this word before. It's a sort of neologism, if that's how you pronounce it. So obviously wearables it's been so much the buzzword of 2014 that people are sick of it now.
Mm-hmm.
But really that in itself is an emerging technology as well, really, if we think about it. It hasn't become mainstream. It's on some kind of adoption curve.
Mm-hmm.
And probably will become mainstream if certain things can be ironed out in the experience, you know, around battery life and interaction modes and just the general social awkwardness of certain wearables. And I won't name names. We all know what those are. So there is this kind of, but then for me, I was just extrapolating out from there and thinking, what, you know, where is the actual end point of this? Because my thinking is that wearables are not the end game in themselves because of all these things, because they're awkward and they're an extra device and they're somehow clumsy and not that intuitive in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then that kind of got me to thinking about a more fragmented device ecosystem, smaller things that you don't really have to interact with, that are somehow spread around your clothing or the things you carry. And then the next logical thing is things on the body.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I was thinking, well, then why can't it just go inside the body? So, which starts to get quite creepy and weird thinking about that. And I remember a talk by a science fiction writer who actually came to Fjord Studio in London. He made this comment, because, you know, obviously science fiction writers think about this sort of thing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a comment that no one wants to look like Terminator. No one wants to have chunks of metal kind of stuck into their body and kind of looking. But you know, that made a lot of sense when he was saying it. But then I was thinking in the years subsequently that actually, maybe some people do want that. Maybe, you know, and people do put bits of metal into their bodies, you know, for different kinds of reasons. For there's health aspects to it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also decoration and jewelry and piercing, and so actually we're not, as a race, we're not that squeamish about doing quite interesting interventions on the body, and there's, I know it's at the fringes of culture, but there's a lot of artistic expressions which are about interventions in the body and doing kind of quite extreme things with piercing and
mm-hmm.
restriction and things like that. So I think it's very, it's in our culture. It's not some kind of totally alien thing. So I think, as long as the intervention, and I think for it to go mainstream, it has to somehow normalize. And a lot of these things do normalize over a long period of time, like tattoos and piercings and so on. But, you know, I think I always think that if there is a very strong perceived benefit to something, people will do it. So,
mm-hmm.
so what are these things that can, you know, what are some of the examples? So that was actually your question. So I've gone off on a rant about why embeddables made sense to me.
No, this is good. This is great.
So I think for me, the first and most obvious examples will be medical.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had interesting chats with molecular bionicists. Did you know that that's a phrase?
No, I did not.
That's an actual job. I know someone who is a molecular bionicist in London, and his teams are working on these very small delivery mechanisms to send specific drug treatments to the part of the body or brain where they will be effective. So he explained to me that the way that most drugs work is it's much like a scattergun thing, is that you take a large quantity of something and it goes around your system in some random way, and some of it will attach to the correct receptors in your brain, and the rest of it just kind of washes around your system and probably doesn't do you any good, and may even do you some harm. So they're working on designing, well, I guess very small machines, nanotechnology, that will navigate through your body and deliver a treatment to the specific receptor in your brain, which I find amazing and fascinating when I see it, that they're actually working on this stuff. And it works on a similar kind of principle to the way that that bacteria kind of navigate. So it's based on detecting certain chemicals and things in the body and then either moving away from them or moving towards them. So it's not literally that it's being steered, but it's using some kind of automatic mechanism. So they're building these things, you know, from building blocks, from components, from proteins and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the kind of next step for that I would see is being some kind of, I've talked about this in a few times, is some kind of factory, some kind of very small factory inside the body that can detect certain changes in your biochemical kind of makeup, and actually produce either treatments or certain compounds that will aid your, you know, either improve your health or aid your general performance physically.
Mm-hmm.
So these are almost like monitoring stations, and they could be that they're just very small, very tiny little factories that can produce a range of different compounds. And then if we think about them also being connected in some way, wirelessly connected and feeding data back into a system, you can start thinking about how medicine and treatment can become a much more automated thing, something that you don't need to do continual interventions in, but you're actually having this stable state being generated inside the body. So, and it sounds a bit speculative and a bit out there, but having spoken to quite a few people about it, it's actually quite well accepted that this is something that will at some point happen. There's nothing technically to stop it. It's just kind of difficult to achieve. Things get kind of absorbed and attacked inside the body, and so things like that would have to be addressed. But that's certainly one thing. And I think that if we're also thinking, kind of coming outside of the body a little bit and thinking about things on the surface of the body, we're seeing things like skin top. Well, I guess the term is skin tops is the idea here, where you can have circuitry that's actually on the skin. You can have tattooed on circuits that can actually monitor and send information back into systems. We've also seen the contact lenses. I think Samsung is one of the companies working on it that can detect diabetes from kind of information out of the eye. But it's not too far to think to leap from there, because actually that one of their challenges is how do you power a contact lens? How do you actually get power into a contact lens? And that's one of the issues with embeddables and kind of skin top wearables and all kinds of wearables in a way is getting power into the device is a big challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about how either kinetic energy from motion or even the heat from the body or even certain chemical reactions inside the body can actually power these things. I think that's an area where people are investigating.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking a bit further on, the contact lens might be a very useful evolution for the glasses wearable, because it starts taking away some of the social awkwardness and the visual awkwardness of the thing and puts it directly onto the eye.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a whole load of technical issues with that, but not insurmountable. As I said, the energy is one thing. Actually making the screens with high enough resolution and small enough inside the lens, but not theoretically not insurmountable. But I think more an issue there would be the issues around privacy and so on.
Because mm-hmm.
if no one knows that you've got one of these things in, then it's far worse. At least if someone's wearing glasses, people know that there's a chance they're being monitored. So I think there's some that would probably cause quite a lot of controversy if it ever emerged.
Absolutely. Which brings up the next question I have for you around embeddables replacing wearables. Do you think that's going to happen, or do you think they'll coexist?
I think they will coexist. I don't think any, technologies do get replaced over time, but it's generally quite an additive process.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't ditched the PC just because we've got tablets and smartphones, and just because watches come out, it doesn't mean people are going to get rid of their smartphones.
Mm-hmm.
I think the way I see it, in fact, the way that we see it at Fjord, because we talk about these things quite a lot, is that it's probably you can either think of it as a constellation or a solar system, you know. So mm-hmm. metaphor is either a lot of things interconnected of equal importance, or there's a device, likely at the moment to be a smartphone, that's the sun in your solar system.
Mm-hmm.
Around it, a whole load of other devices are orbiting in connection with the phone, but doing different things.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe doing very specific things like monitoring certain things in your body, or recording what you're seeing, or analyzing the things that you're saying. I mean, we've all probably heard about this Amazon Echo thing, which I think is a really interesting thing that they've done.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's going away from embeddables, but the idea of a device that's constantly listening to you,
mm-hmm.
interpreting what you want, I think that leads us into a very interesting area. And actually is part of this sort of predictive analytics world that makes up the other component of the embeddables idea, is that it's not just stuff monitoring you, it's actually somehow capturing information about you that's going to make your interactions with the world easier.
Absolutely. Well, that brings up a good point about, you mentioned predictive analytics, and I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how you see data and predictive analytics in particular playing a role in designing for embeddables, and how designers are approaching it.
Mm. Yeah, so it's hugely important that designers embrace this kind of technology,
mm-hmm.
or at least this kind of idea that you're not necessarily designing a solid instance of something anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You're designing for a range of potential outcomes, and those outcomes can be influenced by the behavior of the person in the system, and in fact they should be, because whilst you can't always predict what an individual is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Although that does become easier over time, but you can predict what large groups of people are going to do, or where the main trends of behavior are going to be. And this is what analytics helps us do. I think there's, it's really interesting, I think, what Amazon are doing with their anticipatory shopping, or anticipatory delivery.
Mm-hmm.
So that they don't know what you as a consumer are gonna buy next month, but they know that 10,000 people in the New York area are gonna buy a PlayStation. So they actually start shipping in advance of the orders being made. So it kind of creates this magical experience where you can get pretty much anything you want, you know, not instantaneously, but certainly a lot quicker than you could if it was using a traditional order system, where it would actually have to take the order, have to process it, put something on a truck, and send it to you. Now, with anticipatory shopping, which is based around purely around analytics and looking at trend buying trends. They actually put the stuff on the truck before anyone's ordered it, and it's just in motion, ready to go. And that's one example. And the other example, which is of course last year's, well, let's say, I would have said golden child. Actually, Uber's had quite a lot of issues recently, as you know. So it's, but Uber is one of the most interesting companies, I think, of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And they, what they do is they model entire cities as a system. So they really have incredible knowledge about where people go, what their typical movements and habits are, because actually we're pretty predictable in our daily lives in terms of moving around the city. It's actually quite easy to predict. And apparently their data scientists say that they can predict anyone's movements with about 70% accuracy. So, which is quite scary.
It is.
About it. because we really are that predictable, but certainly in terms of where we go day to day, you know, well, things that we buy maybe is a bit harder to predict, but certainly where we go, where we move. So with that 70% accuracy, that's how they can get you a car in 5 minutes, because they know where, they know in advance where most of the movements are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's leads you on to then, you know, and obviously they've started in New York, they started delivering flu shots last, you know, in last winter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're now saying they can pretty much get you anything. You know, if they, as long as they put the, as long as they have the infrastructure there, they can get you anything in 5 minutes. That's the essence of their business model, which is really incredible when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So these are examples in a mass sense. You know, we're talking about things like Amazon and Uber, which are not really about individual. They are about individual experiences from a customer point of view, but from a delivery point of view, they're a mass system. They're all human to human in the case of Uber, but still on a mass scale.
Right.
When we think about it as you as an individual and start extrapolating from there, then I think it's about all of those signals that we're giving out constantly. Analytics can help us to understand what an individual wants or possibly would want. So let's say, and now we're getting pretty kind of speculative, let's say we can have sensors inside the body that are detecting your emotional and physical reaction to certain tastes or flavors or scents.
Mm-hmm.
And it can build up this profile of you that maybe you would, you know, in a linear, rational way of thinking about things, you might not realize that that's your specific taste. But it could actually know more about what you like than even you do as an individual, because it actually can see the real physiological reactions that you have to certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say this specific type of coffee that you really like, and of course you might be able to judge that, yeah, well, it's slightly better than that one, and you know, I'm not sure that, you know, they're all good coffee shops, but actually these sensors would be able to know precisely which coffee it is that you like, and maybe even then figure out what the right blend or mix is for your ideal type of coffee.
Hmm.
For what you've never had before, because it can kind of plot out, you know, you like this level of bitterness, this amount of caffeine, you know, these maybe different types of coffee you react to in different ways. You like some things about one thing, you like some things about another. So it can kind of create an almost perfectly customized type of coffee for you. Now, this whole thing then demands or would rely on a whole load of other systems somewhere else, i.e. mass customization. Which we're starting to see, in industrial processes, but it's still quite a long way off. The idea of having a coffee blend made specifically for you is probably quite a long way off, but maybe not impossible.
Mm. As you started to talk about that, you know, taste profiles, I immediately thought of the filter bubble. Have you read that?
Yes.
Well, and it's you know, the question becomes, like, I think in this particular case, the example you're describing, it certainly solves part of that. But I question where serendipity goes in all of this, right?
Yes.
And the value of it, and how do you design for that, or can you?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, no. It is a good point. I mean, if we only like what we like, then how do we ever? Because you can be quite surprised at something that you thought you wouldn't like.
Right.
But then, and here's, and I just read this article yesterday, so it's fresh off the press. That I'm not sure who it was that was doing the experiment. It was probably Facebook themselves, but they figured out a list of questions that they can ask an individual
mm-hmm.
that can indicate their affinities and personality types, and they can match, and they've matched that across thousands and thousands and thousands of different individuals who they did this trial with, to the things that they like on Facebook, the likes that they get. So, and what is incredible is that if the number of questions they need to, or the number of likes they need to track for you, starts off quite small, and that will give you a great deal of knowledge about the person. But it doesn't have to go up very high before they can know more about you than your closest people to you in your life.
Oh boy!
Based purely on Facebook likes. So we're talking about whether you like, I don't know, reality TV or Justin Bieber. Really broad and crude things. You think, how can they get anything from that? But somehow the interaction, all these different likes, and as I said, you need to get a lot of them to get to that really high level of fidelity. I think they said they need about 300 to know more about you than your partner, than your spouse would know about you.
Wow.
as an individual with various attitudes and values and tastes. So, yes, I think we like to think that we're these independent beings with wonderful unique characteristics, but we're probably not as much as we think we are.
Right, they've boiled it all down for us, haven't they?
They have. They just need to know whether you like Justin Bieber or not. That's all they need to know.
And then they know what coffee to send you. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So yes, I think there is something that we feel uncomfortable about autonomy and sense of self and, mm-hmm. and sorts of things. But scientists have known for a long time, and I'm talking about, there's the Libet experiment from years ago, where they know that actually a lot of the things that we do, a lot of the actions we do are totally unconscious and subliminal. And we're talking about things really basic, like pressing buttons on things. So they did an experiment where they somehow figured out, or they measured that the impulse to press a button actually starts before you consciously think to do it. Hmm. So something that you're totally not conscious of is driving an action seemingly as binary and voluntary as pressing a button. So there's a lot of thinking in neuroscience that a lot of the things that we do, a lot of our behaviors and actions and things that we think are conscious and voluntary aren't really conscious and voluntary. So yeah, we're getting down a rabbit hole here, but I would say that, you know, from my point of view, and I'm probably quite pragmatic about this and maybe not thinking so much about ethics and morality and stuff here, as long as something is providing me with a better service mm-hmm. and it's giving me something better than what I would have had otherwise, something that's more suited to me, why wouldn't I want it? You know, is it so important for me to dig around and have 10 bad experiences to find the one good one?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I want something that's going to give me the good one pretty much straight away? I would say the latter.
Right. Well, I think in your in one of the chapters that you contributed to, you talked about how all of these things, you know, sensors and gesture control and all of this equal magic, right? And so
yes.
You lean more towards magic than the creep factor. When you look
yes.
at things, as long as it's providing some sort of value.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say, but again, I think until we put these systems out there, and I think this is the role for designers, because I know I didn't actually answer your question. and I think the role for designers is to mediate the creep factor. I think that's always the role in a way. It's like mediating technology, making it more human, making it feel more friendly and you know, the whole field of HCI is really about a realization that machines don't have affinity for us naturally. they don't. It's not they don't like us. They don't care about us. You know, it's not Terminator. But it's, you know, and actually, I think that the first HCI work was actually done on very complicated airplane cockpits, because you know, here we have a very complex interface, very much about the machine, nothing really about how humans can read it and understand it. And actually, it's really problematic, because if you screw up something in an airplane cockpit, the consequences are pretty bad. So I think the designer's role, and now, you know, thinking about what the actual tasks would be in it, I think are a little bit beyond me at this point, because I think it would have to emerge. But thinking about how the designer can mediate this experience where maybe there is no screen, and maybe it's about some kind of other type of communication, that maybe comes through a physical thing, physical product, or, you know, the idea of something turning up on your doorstep that you never ordered. And you know, what is your reaction to that? It's probably not a good reaction. So thinking through, and this is where service design, I think, comes into its own, is that, you know, every part of that experience can be designed in a way that makes it more human-centered, that makes it more about the human and less about these automated systems somewhere going off, doing something, imposing stuff on me, giving me the sense that I'm still somehow in control. Like you said earlier, I think it is important. Whether or not I'm in control or not doesn't matter to me, but I want to feel like I'm in control, because I know that that the world is way too complex for me to try and control it in any meaningful way beyond very kind of near field things. But giving me the sense that it's aware of me, that it's taking account of me, when it does that, it could be delightful. So let's say, in that something turning up on your doorstep thing, the fact that it knows that I'm going to be in most Wednesdays at this time, just because that's a habit that I have, and it just kind of arrives with me at the, you know, when I get home, or, you know, rather than sitting on my doorstep or having to be collected in the you know, downstairs in the lobby or something, you know, those little things, maybe that's the delightful elements that we can design into these systems. So I think it's more about designing a process, maybe, rather than designing a screen or a message or a communication. That's kind of where my head's at.
Interesting. So, you know, obviously you work with plenty of designers at Fjord. What advice do you give to designers that maybe don't have much experience or knowledge of any kind of sensor-based design? What advice do you would you offer them?
I would say start reading. And I'm not going to say what you can start. Obviously, start reading that O'Reilly book. But actually, yes, just I think you have to realize that, yes, you maybe have an art sensibility, but you've got to start thinking about science as well. That really, you know, a lot of design, obviously, that it is a technical field, but it comes from an artistic sensibility, and you know, a lot of the expression is about how things visually look. So naturally, it appeals to certain people, but I think that we need to be equally cognizant of the scientific kind of aspect of what we do. And whether it's, you know, coding and making things out of Arduino, or whether it's actually looking more deeply into some of the underlying sciences and technologies, I think that's a really important first step. And I think it's really interesting that O'Reilly, which I guess traditionally has been more on the technology side, is starting to bring design into the conversation, because I think this is a kind of fusion that we're going to be seeing. We're working on a project with the European Union at the moment around smart materials. And it's something that what I found really interesting, and I think it's the first time they've done this, the EU, is that they're bringing design into an investigative project around a new type of material technology. And typically that would have been material scientists and possibly industrial engineers and people maybe from the more hard end of the science working on that. But what they've acknowledged and recognized really early on is that you need to bring design thinking into the process right up front, because then you can immediately start thinking about the human context. So smart materials are these materials that are piezo-sensitive, and they have organic LED like embedded in the actual material. So essentially you're making a totally flexible, interactive surface that could be applied to more or less anything. And it's early days. It's very early days of that technology, but it's going to really radically transform a lot of things. And again, interesting enough, that the first things that were being discussed in that program were around healthcare, because it could be used in so many different instances. One idea we had was in a accident. You know, treatments area, you know, when they come with those I guess they're like silver foil blankets that they put over
people. Oh yeah,
if you had this kind of technology embedded, you could actually sense the temperature of the person, and actually you could display a red color for those that were, you know, more in danger than those that weren't, you know, in terms of measuring their vital signs. And then you could treat them based on a very precise understanding of who needs to be treated first. So, you know, hundreds and thousands of different other applications that we've been, discussing, thinking about. But what I found most interesting is that they wanted to think about applications even before we figured out how the technology works. And I think we'll start seeing this more, is that designers are being brought into fields that they might never have considered. I think mixing up different industries and specialisms and types of practice and thinking is becoming more and more common. You know, we're applying different intellectual fields to places where we might never have thought. So I heard about MRI scanners being used to detect different, you know, to be applied to astronomy. So using that technology gives a really better way of interpreting the data coming in through telescopes. And these kind of mashups are happening all the time, where we're taking people from very different fields and applying different kinds of thinking. So in my conversations with these molecular bionicists, I was suggesting things that were just kind of random thoughts that came into my head from thinking about the embeddables. And they were going, oh, you know what? Yeah, we could do that. That's a good idea. So, and one of the questions, one of the things he posed to me was, we find it really hard to think more widely or broadly about a problem. We get very laser focused. We go very deep, narrow and deep, which is a very typical scientific approach. Mm-hmm. But designers aren't like that. Designers think kind of shallow and broad, you could say. I'm not saying we're all shallow, but we are trained to think in a more holistic way, pulling in information from different areas of understanding. And that can be very useful in science. So I think, you know, when we're talking about how do you get into this, I would say start looking at the science, start looking at the technologies. You know, you need to have a passion and an interest in it. I'm not saying, you know, everyone should be doing this. I think you do need to have a passion for it. And then I think that your place becomes inevitable, because your type of thinking as a designer is really crucial to making these systems more than just technical experiments, more than just proofs of concept. Applying that contextual thinking about humans and applying it to these new types of sciences can move us forward really quickly. And progressive organizations like the EU and Delft University, who we've been working with, that they've recognized this and brought us into the conversation very early. So that's what I would say.
That's excellent. That's, well, you know, you speak to the promise of design. And I think, you know, that is frankly one of the reasons why we've spent more time and will continue to in the space, because it's like technology. Technology is only as good as it adds value, right? And design, to me, the combination of design and technology, those groups need to come together,
Yes,
in order to really drive what people are looking for, which is a better life.
yeah, absolutely. It's no longer about these two different worlds, which it always was presented as. I don't think it ever really was, but I think even more so now, the need is to bring these two things together.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Andy. I appreciate you making time to talk with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for asking, Mary.